good afternoon. So I have a little exercise about stuff we covered last time, which was talked about fork and exec and wait BID. Here's some code that uses it. Question is, so this code calls fork in a loop that executes twice, then calls wait PID in a loop that executes twice, and the program it's running is echo with an argument of 0, so it's going to print out 0 and a new line. So question is, which are possible outputs? So who thinks A, B, C, D, E, okay, F, G, H, something else, like, there should be 3 zeros, something like that. Okay, so I think the correct answer is E. Someone want to explain who got that, how they got that? Yeah.
It can't be E because it has to wait for both the children process to exit before it can print out 2.
Okay. So yeah, your first observation is that, hey, wait PID has to run for both processes. So something, a preview that some people might not have realized is that we have our parent process running, we call fork once, and then it calls fork again, so we have 2 child processes. And you might worry, well, wait a moment, the child process is running that loop too, doesn't it call fork again? But fortunately, that doesn't happen because it calls exec, and remember, exec never returns. If it didn't call exec, then we'd have to worry, wait, it calls fork again. So we have 2 child processes, and those call exec, and those things that are exec are going to print out 0. And the parent waits for the first one and then waits for the second before it prints out 2. So we know, so here I have a picture of like what happens after what. We know that, I drew these lines from the wrong place. We know that after 0 is printed out, those waits will finish. First 0 and the second 0. So we know that 2 has to be printed out last. So therefore, you eliminated D. Okay, let's go on from that. So we eliminated D. And what was the rest of your reasoning?
Oh, I mean, it can be in any order.
So and you said it can be in any other otherwise. And the reason to think that, notice that, is that we have our parent, it prints out 1 over here, and there's nothing coordinating the parent with the children after they start, besides the wait PIDs. So if we had some other sort of operation, we don't know of one yet, but we'll learn about a few throughout the semester, maybe there'd be some restriction, but there isn't here. So the 1 can be printed out before or after the echoes get to run, because they're just all eligible to run. It's just a matter of like when the timer interrupts happen and what does the OS decide to context switch to. Questions about this? Okay. So last time we covered, so fork, exec, and wait PID. We also talked about how we created new threads and how this integrated with how x86 did context switches. We had to set up a stack so that context switch function would work as if we were in the middle of a call to switch, even though there wasn't any because the thread was just starting. And we mentioned this pattern, this general pattern that you fork, you exec in the child, and you wait in the parent. And we saw sort of an extended example of that in the exercise. So any questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so those of you who've looked at the schedule may have noticed that we have an assignment on shells. So we're going to talk about what is a shell. A shell is a program that allows users, like people at keyboards and mice and other input devices, to run applications. So we talked about the functions to run programs, The shell is the user's wrapper, something that an actual human can use to do that. And the upcoming homework is to make a simple shell. Now, shells take a bunch of forms, and you're most familiar with shells referring to a command line. And POSIX specifies, in fact, you know, this is how command lines work, and so on. But shell is a more general term, so you also have what are sometimes called graphical shells, like the OS X Finder or the Windows Explorer, the thing you use to go through directories and open up applications and open up files. That's a shell. It's just another way of running programs that's accessible to the user, just doesn't use a command line. But we're going to be implementing the POSIX command line, and actually a subset of it, a really small subset. And POSIX specifies some interesting features. So one feature that we kind of glossed over is that it searches for programs. So you can type ls-l, and your shell will figure out in POSIX that, oh, ls is really in /bin, and that's the program I'm going to run. Or you type make, and it figures out, oh, make is really in this /user/bin, because it's not in your directory where you're compiling things. There's a make file, but there's no make program. And it figures that out for you. Another thing that you may have used that shells support is that sometimes you want to run a program and still be able to do other things, so you can run it in the background. So you're seeing the syntax with an ampersand. You can also run programs and send their output somewhere or have them get their input from somewhere else. And you can even run program and have its output go into another program. So in call that pipeline, where some program's output is some filter's input, some filter's input is some program's output. So you can take the output of make and look for something in it with the some filter program. So in our assignment, we're going to have you implement redirection in pipelines. And you might observe that we haven't talked about how output works, and input works, and that's kind of necessary to actually do that. So we're going to talk about that today. We're not going to have you implement these first two features of searching for programs and running programs. Searching for programs, there's actually a POSIX API for. It's not complicated, but we're just keeping the assignment as simple as possible. And running in the background, well, basically it just means you don't call wait PID right away. So it's not complicated to do some version of that, but we're not going to have it in the assignment to keep things simpler. So searching for programs, just to let you know how it is done, in POSIX there's a path environment variable. For example, this might be a possible setting. It has a list of directories separated by colons. You want a directory name containing a colon? Well, that's too bad. And the convention is that the shell checks these in order, so basically it tries every single directory until it works. So a way you might implement this is with a loop that just calls execv, trying each one until something works, in which case execv won't return. And this is an environment variable, so there's actually a set of key value pairs that are associated with every process and sent to processes along with the arguments. That we're not going to talk about again. So then we have redirection and pipelines. Now, then, those are things you're actually going to implement. So in the shell assignment, you're going to support redirections and pipelines, and this is going to be for Linux or another POSIX-like system, not for XV6, because, first of all, it would be annoying to develop it within XV6. XV6 is missing some features you might need. Also, your shell, unlike real normal shells, is going to print the exit code of each program that it runs. So if that's a pipeline, you'll print the exit code of each program in the pipeline. If you're running one program, you'll print the exit code of it, unlike normal shells, which usually don't do that. And we're going to simplify parsing. So we're going to guarantee that everything you need to look for is separated by spaces. So you saw in my example here that I had the output file name right after a greater than sign. We're going to guarantee there's a space around it. So you can just separate things by spaces to do your first step of parsing, because this isn't really a how do you do good text parsing class. And people, even with this simplification, seem to have more trouble than I expect with the parsing part of the shell assignment. Okay, so questions on the assignment? Okay. So, since we have redirection in pipelines, we need to talk about files. And files are, in POSIX, the interface we use to access every sort of input and output from programs. This gets translated into typically actually communicating with devices. You know, so we have these operations, which are typically system calls. We can open a file to set up communicating with something. We can read from it, we can write to it, and we can close it. Files are also going to be used for inter-process communication. So that means talking to another program, which obviously doesn't involve the device, but we still need the kernel's help because we can't access the other program directly. And we're always going to have this basic interface. There might be some other file operations that are added on, but this is where we're going to start, and this is where we're gonna, how we're going to do most of our access to a file. So we have this generic interface. We always have this open operation. So we can't just say right there without some setup. We have to use this open to do the setup. And this is where, in addition to like configuring things, this is where also where access control happens. This is where the OS figures out, are you allowed to access that file? That decision is typically made when you open it, not when you try to read or write it. These read and write calls are going to expect bytes. So this is a byte-oriented interface, even though the real device might not be. You know, so we're going to write bytes to the terminal, but ultimately, like, it's pixels on the screen. Well, too bad. It's going to have to be bytes, and the operating system's going to have to find some way of mapping between the two. You know, or if we're talking to a hard drive, the hard drive can't read and write one byte at a time. It can only do larger parts. The OS is going to figure out how to make that work for us. And we have an explicit close. Now, this byte-oriented part means that accessing things with read and write is less direct than when you might imagine. So this means that, in particular, that the kernel does buffering. So, for example, let's say we get a key press from the keyboard. The kernel is generally going to read that right away, regardless of whether a program actually asked for it. And this makes sense because, you know, if I start typing something, you usually want it to be the case that your program gets that input even if it didn't manage to call read right away. You know, if it's about call read like 1 millisecond later, it'd be really annoying if sometimes it misses your first key press. Also, because we can read numbers of bytes, we typically want to like get the whole line together and so on, so the kernel's going to do buffering for that. So the program is going to ask to read a character, and if the key was already pressed, the system call doing the read is just going to return right away, extracting something from the buffer. Now, it could also be the case that the program asked to read something and a key wasn't pressed. In that case, the read system call will just remember the program wants to read it and wait for the buffer to be filled. And then typically we'll transfer it from the buffer when that program eventually gets run after the key press. Okay, so questions on? This procedure, yes. So the question is, where's the open? So yes, so there has to be an open operation that's not shown. So for our terminal, like in XV6, this is actually done by the first program that runs. And typically something similar is going to be true on another POSIX-like operating system. So that the program that first program that runs is going to need to figure out, how do I open the terminal? Because it did that, other programs don't need to. It's already been opened. Yes?
A lot of cases, you can type on the keyboard, and if your program isn't expecting it, it'll ignore it, but then you'll do something in the program that causes it to expect input, and those previous key presses aren't then loaded in.
So the question, yeah, yes.
But I guess that graph kind of makes it seem like they would be.
So the question is that if I type something and the program isn't expecting input, and then it expects input, it will see those previous key presses. Yeah, this is the typical default behavior. Now, programs which care about this can do things like, say, like make a system call to say, like, to either like read what's already there, but not anything else, or to say, hey, I know there might have been some input discarded. But unless they do something like that explicitly, we'll have the behavior you described of like, you'll queue up input until the program is ready for it. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So I showed this with the keyboard. Something similar also happens with other types of files. So for example, files on disk, the program asks to read a character from a file on disk, and the disk doesn't actually support reading one character at a time. The disk wants to read in much larger units. So what the OS will typically do is it will read a whole block of data from the disk and into a buffer and extract the right part of the buffer for that first read, and subsequent reads will might just go right to the buffer without asking the disk again. And just like we have this buffering for reads, we also have this buffering for writes. So for example, if I print a character to an SSH connection, that's going to be buffered as output waiting for the network. And when the network indicates to the kernel that it's ready, you know, perhaps via an exception, then the kernel will actually send things from that buffer. It is typically not the case that the write operation will wait for the network to be ready. It could do that, but that's not the choice that most POSIX implementations make. And similarly, if I write a character to a file, because the disk expects us to write whole blocks at a time, the operating system will typically have a buffer of data waiting to be written to the disk. And when the disk is ready to do the write and has a whole block to write, it will actually write it to the disk. And it can learn when the disk is ready, perhaps via an exception. So in this model, what read and write do is they move data into and out of a buffer, and the actual I/O operations happen when the kernel figures out that the device is ready for them to happen, when they have input or they're ready for output, and the rules for that are going to depend on the kind of the device. And read and write are going to block, meaning make the program wait, if the buffer is empty or full. So if the buffer is full, you know, and you're writing to the network, because it can't put it in that buffer, it's going to just say, just going to have your program wait. This is the default behavior. You can actually change that. We're not going to talk about how, but you can do it, change it elsewhere. And if the buffer is empty, the default behavior is going to be that we're going to wait for it to have something in it. Yeah. What happens if the buffer for keyword input is full? Yeah, so in that case, the OS has a decision about what to do. So for a keyboard, typically what you'd hope you'd do is that you'd have it be big enough that it usually shouldn't matter. But otherwise, otherwise the OS has to make a decision about what to do, because for the input side of things, you know, it can't just say, stop typing. But when the program's doing it, in POSIX, the typical OS decision is it can tell the program, hey, stop writing. So it takes advantage of it when it can do that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so like if I copy, this is not a keyboard input, let's say I copied like a huge wall of text and then just pasted it right into the shell, how would that affect the, I guess it's a write buffer.
So the question is like you're saying, I'm copying and pasting in a huge block of text into the shell, so how is that going to work? So your shell is actually going to have some file that it's getting input from the program which is implementing the copy-paste operation. So some program implements copy-paste, and it's going to write the information to your shell, directly or indirectly, and that write is going to run out of buffer space and is going to either make that program wait, or if the program configures things, it can figure out, oh, it's taking too long. Is that your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So this is how, you know, we have buffered I/O with the kernel. Now, some of you, if you were paying attention to anything about how things like cout and printf work, you may have remembered that cout and printf do buffering. And you might say, is this the same buffering? No, it isn't. So on a typical Unix system, we have our application, we have our standard library, and you can use cout, printf, cn, you know, gef, gets, and so on, all the functions that the C and C++ standard libraries provide. And those are implemented on top of read and write, which are typically system calls, meaning that there's two layers of buffers. There's the buffers for cout and printf, and the buffers in the kernel. And that's just how things work. And you might say, why are we doing this? Why do we have two layers of buffering? Isn't one enough? And like, you can do everything with one. But the standard library layer provides some things that read and write don't. So one thing they provide is they provide a more convenient interface. So read and write ask for how many bytes do you want. They don't have a read line operation. They don't have formatted import or output. And to implement all of these, you want to have a buffer, for example, for read line. You'd ideally like to read a whole bunch of stuff and extract the first line from it. That means you need to keep the rest of the stuff somewhere. And for formatted output, you'd like to collect all the output somewhere before you send it out. So this is where the extra buffering comes from. It's also a performance thing. So less system calls can be often faster. And having their own buffers lets printf make fewer system calls, potentially. If you've looked at the write count assignment, you may have noticed that xv6, this printf doesn't do this, but a something like Linux is probably will. And this is faster because system calls are slower than normal function calls or copying. So making less of them can make things faster. And it's also more portable. So POSIX only works on Unix-like systems, whereas CN, printf, and so on, you know, are defined to work the same everywhere, including Windows and other platforms that may be a lot more obscure than that. So questions about standard I/O and how it interacts with read and write. Okay, so now we've talked about sort of buffering. We need to talk about, you know, the open operation. Let's start with that. So open, read, open, and we'll then talk about, you know, what we're opening. So when we open things, they have a name. And we have two important types of things, which are regular files. These are files on disk. And directories. And these are things which have obvious names that you've seen, like, you know, like from makefiles and so on. Like foo.c is a regular file. It's a named collection of bytes. You've seen directories, which we have a hierarchy. So directories are, in POSIX, considered a file. They're just a special kind of file, which is why you have the word regular files. And we have this hierarchy of names, and they can contain other directories. And there's also going to be, there's other types of files, you know, too, which we'll talk about when we talk about I/O devices. Other types of files that are in the file system. But the open operation, the primary one we're going to use, is going to take a name of a file, which will typically specify a regular file, possibly using directories, and give us a way to access it for read and write. And this is the POSIX open call. So it takes a path and some flags and optionally a mode. You might wonder, wait, in C, how can you have variable arguments? It works, even though probably this was a bad design choice. And it returns what is called a file descriptor, and we'll talk about what those are later, and that's an integer. So the path is a name of a file in directories, and either is an absolute path, which starts with a slash, meaning it's based on the root of the file system. So in POSIX, there's a single root directory, which everything is contained in. Or it's based on the current working directory. You may know of setting this with cd. There's a library function chdir, which does the equivalent of cd. It's kept track for each program. Looks that up. And it returns a file descriptor. Or on error, like the file doesn't exist, you just by the name doesn't make sense, returns -1. And this value it returns when it's not an error is an index into a table that exists for each process. So there's just an array of open file descriptions, as they're called, information about an open file. And this is what's going to be used by every other system call that deals with files. So we pass the file name, or the path, rather, to open once. Everything else is going to deal with these file descriptors. And they're going to figure out what does the file descriptor mean by going to our process control block and looking up an index in this array, and we're going to tell it what index to look up. And in XP6, this is literally an array. So in our struct proc, there is an array called ofile, which has a max fixed size, which is the maximum number of files you're allowed to have open. They just decided they're set a single maximum. You might say maybe a more featureful OS wouldn't do that. And the idea is file descriptor 0, if open returns 0, that means index 0 into this. 1 means 1, and so on. And note that this is a pointer. So if we don't have a file open with a particular index, it's just going to be a null pointer. And this points to, in XV6, a struct file, which is what represents an open file description. So let's look at what's in a struct file. So there are several types of files. And XV6 supports files that are placeholders, that's none, files that are pipes, and these are ways of communicating with another program. We'll talk about those later. And files that represent any other kind of file. So inodes are, this is for regular files plus IO devices, are both represented using that. It's just a weird choice that they lump the two together, but they do. They have a reference count. So the reference count is the number of pointers to this struct file. So after fork, I said we're going to do a deep copy. That wasn't entirely true. We're going to copy the array, but we're going to have all the pointers be the same. So after fork, the parent and the child will have a pointer to the same struct file. But this means we need to figure out when can I free a struct file. And the way XV6 does that, it keeps track of how many processes are using it with this reference count. So it increments that when there's one more, decrements it when it's closed or a process exits. We have these flags which indicate whether it's readable or writable. So in open, we have to specify, were we opening to read or to write, or both. And this information is recorded here, so we know whether to allow a read or a write operation. Now, you might say, I'm not allowed to write certain files. All that checking needs to happen on open because we recorded the results here that yes, you're allowed to write this. So after that, we have our information that actually points to how we read and write the file, which we'll not talk about much today, but it's there. It just depends on the type of file we have. How do we actually implement the read and write? That points to the stuff we need. And we have an offset. So this is the location in the file. You might say, well, there's some files where I don't have a particular location, like a terminal. In that case, it just won't be meaningful. Okay. So questions? It's in the struct. Yes.
Can you explain again how what you call openly set, like readable and writable?
How do we set readable and writable? So I'll talk about the other arguments to open a bit later, but there's, but you saw in my examples, I said read-only, write-only, or read-write. So, and this is probably something you're familiar with if you used a version of open in like Python or C++ or C. You have to say, do I want to read or write or append or whatever? So this information ends up in the equivalent open system call, and we record that so we know whether read or write is allowed. Okay. So I have these struct files, and you might say, well, we have these numbers, but that's not ever what I've used in my current program. I've just like printf or c-erred. How does that work? So POSIX just has a convention that certain numbers in the certain indexes into this array of file descriptors are special. And the convention is 0 is standard error input, 1 is standard output, and 2 is standard error. And the standard libraries, you know, printf, cout, cerr, and so on, just know this, and we'll use these numbers accordingly. And you could memorize what the numbers are, but there are also constants in the header file unistandard.h. So you can just write the constants, which I find much nicer for reading my code. Why is there a 0 there? Oh, it's actually a file number, not a file descriptor number, not just a random 0. Now, some of you thinking ahead might have noticed, like, we had this assignment for the shell where we needed to change what these are. And when we looked at open, you couldn't choose what open assigns. So we're going to deal with that later. Yeah. There's a question of, like, I already had it open. How do I change it? Open doesn't let me do that. It just gives me a new one. Okay. So I guess, so we'll get to that later. But now we know what file descriptors are. So we mentioned open takes a path. It returns a file descriptor. And it's going to, by default, give us, well, it's always going to give us a new file descriptor, one that's not previously opened. So if we want to replace something that's already opened, we'll have to figure out a different way of doing that. It also takes flags. So this is where we specify, do we want to read, write, or both? Do we want to append? Do we want to truncate a file if it already exists? Do we want to create a new file or give an error if the file doesn't already exist? And you bitwise order these together. You can read the documentation to see what they all are. You also have this mode argument. So the mode argument specifies the permissions if we're creating a new file. So that's why it's optional, because you don't need it if you aren't going to possibly create a new file. We'll talk about what these permissions mean way at the end of the semester. For now, you can always pass this constant, this octal 666, which specifies readable or writable by everyone except as determined by something called a umask, which is typically what you want to do. As I said, we'll talk about what that means much later in the semester, or I can talk about it after lecture. Okay, so that's open. And if we can open files, we can also close them. So we'll get to that next. But first, questions on open. Yeah.
It's kind of going back a little bit. You mentioned that the pointer to the array is copied when you fork a process.
Yes. So the pointer, sorry, I mentioned that the pointer to the array is copied. The pointers in the array are copied. So it's an array of pointers. The array itself is copied, but not the things inside it.
So
each file has its own struct file. One is created each time we call open. And when we fork, we don't create a new one for the child process. We just share it with the parent.
Okay. Oh, it's
the same file. So where this comes up most notably is that we have this offset here. So if you open a file and then fork, the parent and child will share the same offset in the file. Meaning that if the parent writes and then the child writes, the writes will go after each other. Because they're sharing the same offset, not writing independently at the same offset. Other questions? That's a good question. Okay. So there's also a close operation. So close closes the file descriptor, deallocating that array index. It doesn't affect other file descriptors, even ones that refer to the same open file. So this means if I open a file and call fork, and then close the child in the close the file in the child, it's still going to be open in the parent, and everything's going to work fine, even though they were sharing it. That's what our reference count was for in XV6. The way you can think of it is that it just sets the array index to null. Set to null. And if it's actually the last one, the operating system needs to do garbage collection so you don't leak memory. And I guess not mentioned here, files are implicitly closed when you exit. And close returns 0 on success and -1 in error. You might say, wait, how can close fail? So one way close can fail is that you're closing something which isn't open. Right, so that's not important. Another way it can fail, surprisingly, is that it's possible that the operating system might not decide to do all the output operations or until you actually close, and close will tell you if there's an error in those output operations which were deferred. Yes? So a question for the array, I'm referring to, the O file array or the equivalent on another OS. Other questions? Okay. So we have opening, So this means that, like, for example, we had a struct file that takes up some memory in the kernel that will be cleaned up properly when the last reference to the file is closed.
Right, but isn't the array of file descriptor defined in the struct process?
So the array of the file descriptor array is defined there, but it's an array of pointers. Yeah, so it's going to allocate where the pointer points to when that's the last thing using that open file description. No, it's not going to leak memory, is all I'm trying to say. So we had redirection. So now we need to do redirection, and we're going to talk about how we do that. And we have part of the story. So with our open file array, file descriptor array, the big thing we're going to take advantage of is that fork and exec aren't going to change it. So if we call exec, yes, exec is going to allocate new memory and copy arguments and discard everything else, but the open files are the same. So if we want to redirect the output, we just need to change it before we call exec. And for fork, fork just copies the existing array, but the child process has an independent array. So after fork, it's going to be the case that our two programs have pointers to the same open file descriptions. But before we call exec and after fork, we can have some code run in the child that changes where one of those pointers points to a different place. And this won't disrupt the parent. The parent will still have its pointer to its original, say, standard out in this case, even though the child is going elsewhere. But a question we're going to answer in a little bit is, like, how do I make this change, right? Open doesn't do it. Open is going to allocate an entry down here, which is not going to help us. Okay, so questions about what we're going for here? So to implement this redirect output or redirect input operation, your basic pattern is that we're going to do our same fork in the parent wait in the child, we're going to do this extra step of opening some new files and assigning them to file descriptor 0, 1, or 2 before we exec. So our procedure is that, you know, since they're just files, after forking, we're going to open the files to redirect. Probably after forking, we actually could do it earlier. Then we're going to have to make them standard output, error, or input. And the way we're going to do that is with a library call called dupe2, which typically will also be a system call. And then we're going to exec, which will preserve that change. So the reassigning, as I said, is done with dupe2. So dupe2 is a system call which does this operation. So if we're redirecting standard out, we want to set index 1, standard out, to some other index. And it does this assignment, plus deals with like reference counting so we don't like free things too early, and so on. And we need a system call for this because we can't access the array of the open files because that's part of the process control block. It's in the kernel. It's not something we're allowed to change. So we're going to need a system call to do this. So our syscall is going to be dupe2, and it's going to take the from file descriptor and the to one. If you don't memorize that order, you can just look up the manual page. I recommend. It's just going to do this operation plus the bookkeeping so we don't leak memory or have dangling pointers. Okay, so questions? Yes? So that's our dupe2 operation. So it's just going to make a new name, a new index referring to the same open file. Now you might say, what if that file was already opened? For example, we talked about changing standard out, which we could print a standard out before, so it must have been opened. Well, then it's just going to be closed and then reused automatically. So dupe2 is going to handle that detail for us. So for example, here's an example using dupe2 without exec. So I open output.txt, I check for an error, and then I make output.txt be my standard out. And after I do this, writing to standard out, it's going to go to output.txt. And remember I said close just sets an element in the array to null. So after I make standard out point to this open file, I can make the original file descriptor I got from open point to null because I still have a copy of it. I still have a pointer to the same place. This is typically what you'll do because otherwise you'll run out of entries in that array eventually. And I can print out to that output using printf. Yes? Question, is there a way to restore your standard out? Not with this code, but we could have done something where we made a copy of standard out to another number beforehand, and then we could use dupe2 to restore it. Yes?
Is there a dupe1?
Question, is there a dupe1? There is a dupe, which is like dupe2, except it chooses an available file descriptor for the second number. Other questions? Yeah.
To me, it seems like the parameters are reversed in dupe2. Like the first parameter is the old FD and the second one is the new.
The question is the first is the old and the second is the new?
Yeah.
Yes, that is the convention. So the new meaning the one that's going to be assigned to. So we can like draw FD becomes standard out. And yes, don't worry about memorizing that. Just like look it up when you need it. Yeah.
What's that insfd line that talks to? Because it's just number 012.
Which number here?
The second line.
This line. This is a variable to store the output of open, and it's probably not going to be 012 because that's standard in, standard output, standard error. And when we open a new file, it better not be one of those. So it's probably going to be like 3, 4, 5, something like that. We're going to make whatever's the next free. So the rule in POSIX, which I didn't mention, is that it assigns the first free index in the array. Other questions? Okay, so we have our operations, and we can think of them as manipulating this array. So open is going to choose a new file descriptor number, one that's available, assign to it, dupe to assigns one to it from another, and close assigns one to null, plus some bookkeeping to make sure we don't have dangling pointers, leak memory, and so on. And fork just copies the whole array of pointers. Okay. Questions? Yes. And so this dupe to operation is sort of the missing piece we needed to actually do our redirection. So our redirection is we can open something, make it standard in, standard out, standard error, assign it to the number for that, close the original so we have all the available space in the array we can, and that's it. And we're going to do something similar to handle that pipeline, but we'll need an extra piece. Okay. So I've talked about managing file descriptors. I'll talk a little more about what are the read and write operations. I mentioned before that they're byte-oriented. So that means that they take a buffer of bytes and a size of the stuff in the buffer. So for read, this is the maximum size to read. Read is not guaranteed to read that much. It's up to that many bytes. For write, it's the maximum size to write. Write is not guaranteed to write that many bytes. And that's the maximum size it might do. And it returns the number of bytes read or written, so number actually were read or written, or on an error, negative one. Read can return zero. And zero is different than an error because zero means you're end of file, that yes, I was successful, but there was nothing to read. So to give an example of what these look like, here I have reading from standard in, one byte at a time. Since it's one byte, my buffer is a single character. I ask to check the amount read. As long as I'm reading at least one character, I'm, in this case, appending it to a string. And at the end, I check, did I end up reading an error? You know, have an error from read, and so I print an error message. Otherwise, you know, I reach the end of the file, I have that zero return saying, yes, we're successful, but there was nothing more to read. Okay. So this is sort of the simplest usage of read. And this will work, but you know, this is kind of tedious. If we want to read a big file, we probably want to read not one byte at a time. So we want to take advantage of that. We can read a lot of stuff. So safe code to do this might look something like this. This is code to read 1 kilobyte. So I have a kilobyte buffer, and I read from the buffer at an offset up to the end of the buffer. And my offset starts at zero. And the problem I have to deal with here is that depending on what type of thing I'm reading from, it's possible that read won't get everything. So I keep reading. I advance my offset based on how much is read until I get to end of file, so the amount read was zero, or I managed to read as much as I wanted to, or I experienced an error of some sort. And this sort of annoyance is one reason why you might prefer like standard input interface, which you won't have to deal with this sort of thing. So you might ask, how could I read less than I request? So what POSIX typically does for regular files is that read, in fact, will read everything. That, you know, if you ask to read a kilobyte, if there's a kilobyte in the file, it will read it right away, before returning at least. But for other types of files, like terminals, like keyboard input, it will usually give you what's available after waiting for anything to be available. And this makes sense, right? If I type one line at the keyboard and you ask to read a kilobyte, you probably want to get that line rather than waiting for me to type a whole kilobyte. But this is just the choice that POSIX has made. But this means that you need to worry about for things like keyboards, networks, and so on, that you might read less than you request. And you need to figure out, is that okay? You know, like, did I get a whole line of input, or do I want to call read again? Is there more to get? questions on read? Yeah. So the question is, how do I solve what problem exactly?
So like you have a certain size of the read buffer, and you're saying like if you type in a line on the keyboard, you don't want to wait until it's filled.
So the question is, how do I figure out when to stop reading? This is application dependent. So if I'm expecting a line of input, what I'm going to do is I'm probably going to have a loop like this, but I'm going to have like an extra check here, like if I read a whole line, a whole line return. And then also need to do something about where do I put the, if I write another line, where do I put it? And that's basically, in fact, what like standard read line in C++ or fgets do. So they do a loop like this, but they check, did I read a whole line? If so, return that line. And keep the rest of the stuff somewhere for later. Other questions? Okay. So we also have write. So write, for example, here, I can write to a file descriptor, I have my buffer, and the amount of stuff, you know, the size in bytes I want to write from that. Write has a return value, so if you want to do error checking, you should check what's the return value, and it's how much is written. And again, negative values mean that we had an error of some sort. But we can also have it technically write less than's requested. This, fortunately, is a lot less common than reading partially, because the default behavior that POSIX has chosen is more convenient for this. It's that, you know, we'll only have write less than you asked for if there's an error. So for example, let's say I'm sending stuff to the network and then I unplug my network cable. Then I might write a whole bunch and write will return less than I requested because you couldn't send everything. But it will tell you, I sent the first kilobyte, then you call write again and it will say, nope, the network's down. Or interruption, though you can request otherwise. So it will usually wait till it completes to do this. So this means that if there's not enough space in the buffer in the kernel, what write's typically going to do is it's just going to wait for the space to free up. So for example, let's say I'm writing to a network, it's going to wait for stuff to go out of the network so there's now more space to have the stuff waiting to go out, rather than writing less than you asked for. You can request different behavior, but we're not going to talk about how to do this. Questions about write and partial writes? So here's a little exercise. So we talked about write, read, dupe2. So here's some code that uses dupe2. So let's say, assuming open dupe2, don't fail, and write works as long as the file descriptor is valid. And let's assume that file descriptor number 100, so I'm doing the trick you asked about saving standard out. I'm doing that trick to save standard out in 100, or at least trying to, was closed, and standard out file now is open. So what's going to be written to output.txt by this code? You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree here. And as a reminder, the direction of dupe2 is the assignment goes to the second array. Once more time. Okay.
Do we know what FD is?
What FD?
Yeah.
It's the return value of open. It is. You can assume that open returns a value that is other than 100. 100 is just a closed file descriptor. Yes. Yeah. And so, yeah, I'll write that down here. Yeah, and it's not, I wrote that down here. FD100 is not what open returns. Any still people want more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E, K? We're kind of split. So let's track what the file descriptors are. We have standard out, we have FD, whatever that is, and 100. And initially, our state is that standard out is the terminal. FD, after we call the open, is output.txt, and 100 is closed. So then we write A to output.txt. So our output.txt contains A, and then we do this dupe 2. So after that, we say standard out and assign it to index 100. So now index 100 points to the terminal. Then we do this operation second dupe 2, and this says take file descriptor and assign it to standard out. So now standard out also points to output.txt. So we just have two file descriptors that both refer to output.txt. And then we write to standard out, which if we look at our table is output.txt, B. So we have a B output. Then we write to output.txt, C. And because they're actually the same open file description, they share offsets. We don't have to worry about B overwriting C. They actually share the offset because it's the same pointer. Then we close FD, and all this does, this close operation, remember, is it just sets the entry to null. So this is 1 and 2 up here, and then 3 is that we just set that to null. But it doesn't change where standard out points. So then we write to standard out, we look up where standard out goes, it goes to output.txt, so we have a D there. Then we write to 100, and we look up where that goes, it goes to the terminal. So the terminal gets, we have an E output to the terminal. And so that's how I get an answer of B. Questions? How I did that? Yes?
Does
dupe2 automatically open the file for you? It doesn't change, it doesn't open it for you, but it assign, makes it have another name, another file descriptor that refers to it.
Right, but how did the file with 100, like, version of my process, open file, create?
So how did which file?
The 100 file.
How did the 100 file? Oh, so we just assigned element 100 of the array to point to an existing open file. So it was previously null because it was closed. And we assigned it to actually not be closed.
Okay.
Yes?
How do you know 100 points to the terminal?
How do we know 100 points to the terminal? So initially it pointed to nothing because the question said so. But this standard out initially pointed to the terminal, and this dupe 2, this labeled 1, did that assignment. It said open file 100 equals open file of 1. Open file of 1 was the terminal, so now 100 is the terminal 2. Other questions? Okay. So before I leave read and write, one last note is that I mentioned we have standard IO, CNC out, scanf, and so on. And we have this read and write. You might be tempted, well, read and write sometimes more convenient. CNC out sometimes more convenient. Let's just use whatever's convenient. Don't do that. Don't mix them unless you're really careful, because it won't work very well. And the problem is, like, CN and scanf, like, will read extra stuff that you won't get yet, because they're, you know, keeping stuff around that's extra stuff they got from the read system call, because they, like, read a line and some extra stuff, and you only got the line. Or if you're printing stuff out, they won't print everything out right away. They'll try to, like, group things and have larger write calls, which is more efficient. So don't assume mixing read and write calls and these things will work unless you're careful. And the way to be careful is there's some way of saying, please clear out your buffers, CN or printf. Okay. On that note, talk about implementing pipelines. And for this, we're going to have a special kind of file called a pipe. And a pipe is a file that just exists for communicating between different programs. Bytes go in one of the pipe, and the same bytes come out the other end. And you can create a pipe with the pipe library call. And this is, in fact, what you should use in the shell assignment for implementing pipelines, that rather than redirecting output to a file, you'll redirect it to a pipe. Rather than redirecting input from a file, you'll redirect it from a pipe. And using that pipe, you'll have two programs connected to each other. So one program will put bytes in one of the pipe, the other program will read bytes from the other end, and that's how the output will go from one to the input of the other. So the way you use pipes, there's this pipe library call. It takes an array of two file descriptors, and when it's successful, it returns zero, and assigns the first element of the array to a read file descriptor that it allocates, and the second to a write one. And if you write to the write file descriptor, you can read the same stuff from the read file descriptor. Okay. So, question? Here. So something to note about pipe, here's some code which doesn't work. So I told you we can read from one end, write to one end, and read from the other. So I'm doing exactly that. And this code will work when this sum big size is small. It does the right thing. But when sum big size gets big, suddenly it stops working. And it just hangs. This has something to do with buffering. Tell me what might be going on here. So I'm making a pipe. I'm writing to the right end, reading from the read end. If I have some big size be like 10, everything works great. I basically read the same thing out that I got read in, just copy operation. If I had some buffer be different, it would do the copy. Otherwise, I get hanging. So what's going on? Yeah? The question is, because write waits for the system to clear out its memory? Yes. So our pipe is going to have a buffer. And the buffer, we're going to write into the buffer. And when that fills up, it's waiting for something to read it. And remember we said that write is just going to block if we're not able to write into the buffer right away. So it just blocks until something reads it. But nothing gets to read it because the thing that's going to read it won't happen until after the write returns. So it will never happen. So this is known as a deadlock. So this is not actually a valid use of pipes, because we just have that buffer. And the policy that POSIX has chosen is that pipes have a limited buffer size, because otherwise, you know, how much memory could we end up using? Like, could, like, have gigabytes accidentally be used? So we just prevent that by having a relatively small buffer. And this means that when we have, you know, a command like ls through grep for something, that if ls produces tons and tons of output and grep is slow, then ls will slow down, which is usually what we want. If we had a huge, huge buffer, like used all of memory for it, then we just use more and more space, even though that's not useful. So let's give an example that avoids this problem. And one way we can avoid this problem is by reading and writing in different processes. In this case, the write operation will need to wait for the read to happen, but that's fine because they're happening in parallel. So the read will be taking stuff out of the buffer as the write is putting stuff in. So, you know, there's no problem there. So here's our use, where I create my pipe, and then I fork, and now my child and parent have the same pipe. And what I do is I just have my code to deal with, you know, writing and reading, and just use the appropriate end from the child in this case. I've chosen to write and have the parent read, which is the choice I've made. So something you might notice here is that I have closes. In particular, one of them is extremely important, and that's this one. So when you read from a pipe, read can give you end of file, indicate that we're done with the file. The rule for pipes is that it only does that if there's no possible way for anyone to write to the pipe. And the rule for determining that is that if there's any open file pointing to the right end of the pipe, that means someone can write. So if the parent is expecting this read from pipe to look for EOF, end of file, then it has to close the write end. Otherwise, it's never going to get it because the operating system is going to say, oh, well, no, it's not end of file because maybe you're going to write to your own pipe, even though that seems silly. Questions? Yes. Okay. So I also have some less important closes that you should still get into the habit of doing, because otherwise we have our open file array and we'll run out of space in it if we keep doing this. And in something like a shell, that would be really inconvenient if, like, after I run 100 commands, suddenly my shell doesn't work anymore because there are no more files to open. So this is an example where I'm writing from parent to child, but in your shell, when we think about a pipeline, we actually want two children to write to each other. But we're going to use a similar pattern for that. So here's an example of what that might look like. I create my pipe. I have my two file descriptors. I make one child to run ls in this case, and I set ls's output to be the right end of the pipe. I make another child to run grep in this case, and I set its input to be the other end of the pipe, the read end. And after I'm done that, I make sure I close both ends, both so I don't run out of open files, and because I need to make sure that grep realizes when ls is done writing. And by the rule I just told you, that's not going to happen if the parent could potentially write, even though we know it wouldn't. Okay, so questions on this code? Yes. So the question is, why am I calling close for the same file descriptor three times? And the answer is that we have different open file arrays at that point. So I have a picture which might help. So let's say I call pipe, I get 3 and 4 for those two things in the array. After I fork the first child, I'm closing its copy, but the parent's one still lives on because this is a copy operation. So we have one copy where it's closed, the other where it's not yet closed. And when I make the second child, we also have one copy where it's closed, one where it's not yet closed. So I need all those closes to make sure there's no remaining copy that points to that with that index. Yes?
In child 2, why are you closing 4 after the read operation?
Question, why am I closing 4 after the read operation? So this doesn't represent a read operation, though that's not obvious. This is a dupe 2. The actual, this is reads standard in, and this here writes standard out. That's where the actual reading and writing is happening. And it's not via 3 and 4, it's via standard in, standard out, which is why we can close them and still have the read and write happen. Other questions? So this gives you the basic pattern you're going to need for the shell assignment for X. So I'm going to go through some corner cases. So let's have a little exercise here. So here's some code where we have two programs, you know, just like I showed in my example of like writing from the child, reading from the parent. I probably should pass an exit status, but so on. And I'm even doing the thing where in the parent, I'm closing the right end of the pipe so I can properly get EOF if I wanted to get it. And I expect that I'm going to read 1 byte. But instead, I read 0 bytes. Count is 0, meaning I got end of file. Even though the child writes something before it exits. So before it closes. So what happened? There's a bug in this code. Pretty subtle bug, in fact. Back there? Yeah.
Did the parent need to read before the child wrote?
The parent needs to read before the child wrote?
Is that the bug? That the parent reads?
So your question is like, maybe the bug is the parent reads before the child writes? So helpfully, the rule for read is that read is going to wait by default until there's something available. Or we know that we're at end of file. So that's not a problem. So it doesn't matter what order the parent reads in because of that rule. If we like set this to tell the system, give me what you have right away, then yes, that would be a problem. Yeah?
Is it because the write was never closed in the child?
Is it because the write end was never closed in the child? So that is something to be concerned about, but this exit operation, exiting the child, is going to automatically close everything. So that's okay. The child didn't exit, that might be a concern, but we're only reading 1 byte, and we should be able to get 1 byte even if the child doesn't close. Yeah?
The parent code ran before the child
was closed.
The parent what?
Code ran before the child. So if, because of, what do you mean, which, you mean this code here runs before this code? So that's not a problem because the read is going to wait for something to be available. Or to know that there's nothing more available. Yeah?
Fork happens before assigning the file descriptor.
So you're saying fork happened before we assign the file descriptor. Yes. So the bug here, which is a real bug that people commonly make, is that we called fork, and we made a pipe here, and a pipe here, and they're different pipes. So the parent is reading from a pipe that just closed that no one else ever had open. And the child is writing to a pipe that it just opened that no one else is reading from. And no one else has opened for reading. So that's a nice subtle issue with that. That's, I think, where I'll leave off today.